Welcome to the Commonwealth Club Music Matters series of presentations, which are sponsored by Ernest & Young and the John and Martha Goldman Foundation. My name is Patrick O'Reilly, and I'm delighted, truly delighted beyond measure, to introduce our speaker tonight, Mr. Country Joe McDonald. On a personal note, I've been a big fan since I was a teenager, so this is very exciting for me. Mr. McDonald was a founding member of the seminal and iconic rock band Country Joe and the Fish, which did outstanding performances at the Monterey Pop Festival and in Woodstock, which, by the way, you can watch on YouTube. Their song, Fixing to Die Rag, was the anthem of the anti-war movement in the 60s and early 70s, and there are very few people who came of age at that time who don't know the words to that song. Maybe none. The music Country Joe and the Fish recorded is timeless and at the same time evocative of that era. They recorded 6 albums, and as a solo artist, Joe has recorded 30 albums, if I counted correctly, and each album is exceptional. His latest release, Time Flies By, is proof that Country Joe McDonald is one of America's finest songwriters, and he just keeps getting better. I want to note, too, that Joe has been instrumental in introducing the music of Woody Guthrie to a much wider audience, and he's recorded 2 albums of songs by Woody Guthrie, as well as producing a CD by Woody Guthrie's son, Jody Guthrie. I also want to acknowledge Mr. McDonald's dedication to the nursing profession and the considerable efforts he has made to educate the public about the important work nurses do. He is a noted authority on the life of Florence Nightingale and has incidentally donated his extensive historical collection on nursing to the University of California, San Francisco. His CDs, A Tribute to Florence Nightingale and Thank the Nurse, are truly brilliant. So please give a warm welcome to Mr. Country Joe McDonald.
Time go, somebody tell me, I need to know. We were so young and now we're so old. Oh, where did the time go? Our babies were born and now they are grown with their own lives, kids of their own. Friends and loved ones have moved away, and yesterday's moments turn into today. Oh, where did the time go? Somebody tell me, I need to know. We were so young, now we're so old. Oh, where did the time go? Only yesterday we rocked and we rolled, upsetting our parents and the status quo. And now we're all middle of the road. Oh, where did the time go?
Thank you. I really, I don't think I've ever done something like this before, speaking and this sort of thing, but Patrick is friends of a neighbor of mine, and he asked me to do this, and I consented, so here I am. That song that I just sang is part of a new album that I made, which is called 50. It's 50 years since my first album, which is incomprehensible to me. And there's about 36 albums now. I've been agonizing over this thing because I don't know how to speak like this. And I was meeting with the mayor of Berkeley, Tom Bates, about a veterans thing, idea that I had, and 2 days ago. And he told me, he said, oh, it's no problem, Joe. You just make an outline. And you just make an outline, and then and that's what you do. And then I remembered that over the years, when I went to school, that was high school and air traffic control school in the Navy and three semesters of college, that I was taught that you take Roman numerals, like Roman numeral one, and then under that, uppercase A, and then under that, lowercase a, and it can go lowercase a, lowercase b, lowercase c. And then you do Roman numeral two, and then under that, uppercase. I learned that, but I've never made an outline. So that when even my wife told me, oh, yeah, you should make an outline. And so I didn't do that. So I didn't do that, but Patrick told me that when he was in high school, he heard a Country Joe and the Fish song on the radio. This is about this talk is about music. What? Music, social change, something about music and social change. Yeah. As an instrument. Thank you. Music as a vehicle for social justice.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know anything about that. But it's a damn fine title. Just try to imagine a world without music, and that would be pretty terrible. But Patrick told me he was in high school, he was listening to the radio. Yeah, I think it was Stockton or something, and he heard the Harlem song, and I'd never heard anybody in all those years. That was that album was it was a long, long time ago, and it was about a racial thing, and it was I was in Los Angeles. The group Country Down the Fish could not get along with each other, so the bass player's father was a psychologist in Southern California with the airplane industry, and he led group sessions, and he had us. We were down there learning how to talk to each other and get along better, and that didn't really work. But what I did was I found that he had Sunset magazines in his house, and instead of learning how to talk to people, I was reading the Sunset magazine, and I noticed they had travel adverts in the magazine, and from that, I wrote the Harlem song, which I don't think I've ever performed in public before. And so I'm going to do that because Patrick said that he liked the Harlem song. I have no idea how the guitar part goes because I haven't played it in 50 years. Well, 45 years. So, but I'm going to do the Harlem song for you now. And it's oddly timely. Harlem is a section of New York City where African-American people lived. I don't know who lives there now. We called them black people back then. So, okay, here it goes. Glorious, breathtaking, spectacular. Relax in the grandeur of America's yesteryear. Harlem, land of enchanting contrasts, where the romantic past touches hands with the exciting present. First, the pleasure of being received with warmth and genuine hospitality. Then, the easy adjustment to the comfort and style of superb meals, exotic beverages, colorful entertainment, and dynamite action. Doing all the wonderful things that wonderful vacations are made of at wonderful savings, too. Yes, come to Harlem, the happy meeting ground for families with large wants and small budgets. See colorful Harlem in New York City, come treat yourself to some grits and barbecue. Bring the family to Harlem in New York City for a summer of fun, dancing to the rhythm and blues. And if you're looking for the action, this summer is your chance. All the black folks are just dying to watch you sing and dance. in carefree Harlem, that's New York City, where every soulful spade has a serenade just for you. Discover glorious Harlem in New York City. There's thrills and chills in the land of rhythm and blues. Bring the family to Harlem in New York City. You'll have fun in the sun doing what the black folks do. And every little pickaninny wears a great big grin, just hanging around waiting for some white folks to drop in. But if you can't go to Harlem, that's New York City, maybe you'll be lucky and Harlem will come to you. I don't think that got a lot of airplay. Tragically, it's more poignant than ever. Some of my... I don't know if music changes people. It provides you comfort and solace, and if you're part of a minority, it can validate how you feel. And that's what I try to do with my... I grew up with... My parents were members of the American Communist Party, and at that particular time, the Communist Party was making music and as propaganda, and Woody Guthrie was a part of that, and we had 78 records in my house. So I grew up with this topical songs. With Bob Dylan, they became known as protest songs, but I grew up with topicals, all different subjects, and so it was natural for me to write songs about different subjects. And sometimes, mostly I wrote songs to just and music just to keep from going crazy, and I think I've succeeded in doing that. And also I've succeeded in making some money. And I never know that anybody will show up. In the audience today is a guy I was in the Navy with when I was 18 years old in Japan. He wrote a book about his adventures and my adventures. He was a retired school teacher from San Francisco. We moved up here from El Monte, which was the home of the American Nazi Party, actually. That's why my parents chose to move there. Ironic, isn't it? And then I moved to Berkeley in 65. So we just had an anniversary of... I have no idea what I'm going to do up here, really. Let's see. I have some stories that I can tell. People seem to like the stories. I wrote a song for a guy who wrote for the Berkeley Barb underground newspaper, Eugene Schoenfeld. He was called Dr. Hip, and I wrote his theme song for him. We just celebrated 50 years of the Berkeley Barb in Berkeley, and I was part of that. And he mentioned that one of the great things about the Berkeley Barb was that they wrote about smoking banana peels. And how many people here have ever smoked banana peels? Come on, raise your hand. Look at that, it's 5, 6, 7, 8 people. Oh my God. The stems and seeds of a banana peel, yeah. My usual audience is a lot younger than you people, but I don't know. It's odd. I got this jacket at Ross, and it was really cheap, but there's no pockets in it. I keep wanting to put my hands in the... It's a cheap jacket, but it looks nice, doesn't it? You know. So anyway, the story about banana peels happened because we were flying up to Vancouver, British Columbia, in like 1967 or 68 to perform Country Joe and the Fish. That was the drummer Chicken Hirsch, Gary Chicken Hirsch, told me on the plane up there that he had figured out that banana peels had the same chemical composition as marijuana, and if you dried the peels off and scraped the white stuff off and smoked it, it would get you high. And at that time, we were living just on peanut butter and banana sandwiches, you know. And we just threw the peelings away. So I thought, wow, this is a great idea. So we went up there. We landed at Vancouver, and we went over to the Kitsilano district, which was the Haight-Ashbury area of Vancouver. And across the street from the Kitsilano Theater, there was a psychedelic shop. How many people remember psychedelic shops? Oh, yeah. Yeah. So they had a Jimi Hendrix poster, I think, and some rolling papers. I went to Linda, and I said to her, while they were setting up the gear, I told her about the banana thing and asked her if we could use the kitchen in the back room of the psychedelic shop to use the oven to dry banana peels. And she said, yeah, that'll be fine. So I went up on the corner. There was a mom-and-pop grocery store up there, and I bought a bunch of bananas, and we went back into the kitchen of the psychedelic shop, and we turned the oven on a very low temperature so we wouldn't destroy the THC in the banana peels. And then we peeled the bananas, and we ate the bananas, of course, and we put the peels in the oven. And then we just sat there, you know, shooting the shit, just talking, chilling, and looking around and catching up on stuff. And the roadies came over, and they said, it's time for the sound check. So we went back across the street to the Kitsilano Theater, and it was pretty much like this. It had been a dance hall or something like that. It was pretty much looked like this. And there was a stage just pretty much like this. We had played there before. The stage crew said, you see that water jar over there? We dissolved 100 tabs of LSD in that water jar. And during the night, if you want to, just take a sip off the water jar. So we all took a sip out of the water jar, and then we did our sound check. And then we went back across the street into the psychedelic shop and into the back room of the psychedelic shop to test the banana peels. They were really too damp. We couldn't smoke them. So we just were, you know, talking and stuff. And then the roadies came over. They said, it's time for the first set. So we went back across the street into the Kitsilano Theater and up on the stage and took a couple more sips off of the water jar. And then we played our first set. And then we went back across the street into the psychedelic shop, back in the back room, and the banana peels were dry, you know. And so we scraped off a bunch of the white stuff from the banana peels, and we asked Linda at the psychedelic shop if we could have some rolling papers. She gave us a bunch of rolling papers, and we rolled up about 50 banana joints, and we started smoking them. And we were looking at each other going, are you getting high? I don't, yeah, maybe, I don't know, I don't, maybe, yeah, maybe, I think, I don't know, you know? So we did that for about an hour, and then we went back across the street to the Kitsilano Theater, and we took a couple sips off that water jar, and then we did our last set, and the last set we played one song. It's Not So Sweet Martha Lorraine, and we started the set with that song, and we couldn't stop it. And we played for an hour. We played the song for an hour. All the time we were playing, I was thinking, how the fuck do I stop this song? Finally, we managed to stop it, and the press asked, I said, well, that's unusual. I said, well, we're into jazz, you know. So we went back across the street, back into the psychedelic shop, into the kitchen, and we, you know, started smoking those banana joints, saying, I don't know about you, man, but I am so high. I can't believe it. It's banana. It really, really works. It gets you so high. And so we rolled up a bunch of banana joints. We went around to some parties in Vancouver, and we told people it's banana, it gets you high. They thought we were crazy. I guess technically we were crazy. We flew back to Berkeley, and I went up on Telegraph Avenue with a pipe full of banana yuck, and I made all my friends smoke it. I said, it's banana, it gets you high. And they went, oh, yeah, right, you know. And then the next day we played in San Francisco, California Hall. A lot of you probably went to concerts at California. It was sponsored by Normal, the organization which is still effective, trying to legalize marijuana. And we passed out into the audience 500 banana joints that night. We told everybody, it's banana, it gets you high. And then we had some time off. And then I woke up in the morning and I went over to Safeway to get our breakfast, which is bananas. And there was no bananas in the banana bin. I thought, wow, that's weird, you know? And then I went over to the co-op, and there was no bananas at co-op. You couldn't get a banana in Berkeley that day. And I was walking back. I was walking back to the apartment, and I saw a Chronicle news rack with a Chronicle on it. It's a bit 3-inch headline. It said, "Banana turn on new hippie craze." And then we forgot about it. And 3 months later, I was reading in the Chronicle, back in the back, there was a little tiny headline that said, DEA smokes banana joint. And I thought, what the fuck? So I read the article. In Washington, D.C., they had joint smoking machines, probably very expensive, made by General Electric. And they smoked the banana joint through it, and it did nothing. And then I remembered the LSD water that we drank. So I went over to Chicken's house with a newspaper, and I told him, I said, "You told us that bananas get you high. The DEA smoked banana. It doesn't do a thing. It was all that acid water that we drank that night that got us high." He said, "Forget about it. I figured out last night if you smoke a cigarette through a bell pepper, it gets you really stoned." Really, really stoned. So I'm most famous for writing a song about the Vietnam War called "I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag." Most people don't know that I am a military veteran. I enlisted in the Navy out of El Monte, where I grew up in Southern California when I was 17 years old. Like a friend of mine who took off all his clothes and jumped into some cactus that afterwards, it seemed like a good idea at the time. I wrote the song in 1965 when I moved to Berkeley, and we recorded it on a little extended play record. And then when Bob Dylan, it was a skiffle band then, and when Bob Dylan went electric, Country Joe and the Fish, we invented the name Country Joe and the Fish for that record and sold it at Moe's Books in Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley. And then Dylan went electric, we went electric, we got signed to Vanguard Records and put the song on the second album. And Country Joe and the Fish got assigned to Woodstock about 3 weeks before. We're not on the poster because we had our some people from our office who were working there and lobbied for us to be on there. It was between us and Jethro Tull, and we got it. We got the spot. And I went out there early because I like to go to festivals, and I like to go early and watch the stage setting up and the whole production thing. And I went there early, and I was hanging around on the stage. And the traffic was really bad at the Woodstock Festival, and Santana was supposed to go on, but they were late, and so one of the guys, John Roberts, came over. No, not John Roberts. John Morris came over, and he said, "Would you do a solo act?" And I said, "You know, just to fill in time." And I said, "No, I don't want to because it's." I was, but anyway, they got a guitar. They tied a rope onto it. They pushed me out there, and I did it. And then nobody was paying any attention to me at all. And I got kind of brave. I walked over, and I asked my partner, Bill Belmont, if it would be okay if I did the "Fuck Cheer" and "Fixing to Die Rag." And he said, "Well, nobody's paying any attention to you, so do whatever you want." And so I did it. And then it got put in the movie, and that's probably one of the things that you know about me. Is how many people have seen the Woodstock movie? Yeah, right. Yeah. It was quite a phenomenon, incredible thing. So we continued to do... we were doing the "Fuck Cheer." You see, we were playing at Central Park in New York City before Woodstock. The reason the people at Woodstock knew the "Fuck Cheer," we originally put it we originally recorded this song, and I invented the "Fish Cheer" because people were not paying attention to me. I was the head of the student band director in my hometown in El Monte, and we used to spell out the Arroyo Knights. We would spell out the name of the Knights at sporting events. And so I thought we should spell out "fish" because we're called the Fish. And so we all spelled a letter on the record. We said, "Give me an F," and then we overdubbed people yelling F, "K, Give me an I, give me an S, give me an H. What's that spell? Fish. And we overed up people screaming fish. And then we put that in front of the song Fixing to Die Rag about the Vietnam War. It didn't make any sense, but it was the 60s and nobody cared. So people got in the habit of yelling fish when I asked them to, or we asked them to, and then we would do Fixing to Die Rag. And we were playing, we did that for a while, and then we were playing at Central Park in New York City for the Schaefer Beer Company. They put on the Schaefer Beer Festival there, and in Waltham Rink Arena, I think is what it's called. And the Ed Sullivan Show, which was the biggest variety show on television at that time. Of course, there was only three channels, I think, of television at that time. But anyway, they had hired Country Joe and the Fish to be on the show at Christmas time, and they paid us in advance to be on the show. And since they were out of New York City, when we played Central Park in New York City, they came to check out the show. And also, the drummer, Chicken Hirsch, who had invented the banana thing, so we knew he had good ideas, said, why don't we do the fuck cheer tonight instead of the fish cheer, because it's a four-letter word beginning with F. And we said, perfect. And so that night, for the first time ever, we did the fuck cheer, and we sang Fixing to Die Rag. The audience really loved it. There was like a near riot. There was like 20,000 people there. And outside the barriers, another 20,000 people. We went back in the dressing room, congratulated ourselves on our new idea, and we were really happy until the Schaefer Beer Company rep stuck his head in and he said, you'll never be on the Schaefer Beer Festival again in your lives. And we figured, fuck them, it's lousy beer anyway. But then the Ed Sullivan Show guy came in, and he said, you can keep the money, but you're never going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. And that did depress us. But, you know, over the years, there was one show, Hollywood Squares, on television, a quiz show, and they used to ask, who was paid to stay off the Ed Sullivan Show? And the answer was Country Joe and the Fish. So we kept on doing the song, and everybody kept on loving it, you know, until we got to Worcester, Massachusetts, and we played in Worcester, Massachusetts, and we did the cheer, and nothing strange happened. Then we left to go to Boston to play at the Boston Gardens, and there were two cops at the show, and they went back to the station and told the police captain there about the fuck cheer, and he got upset, and he called the Boston police and told them about it. So when we got to Boston, we were met by 100 uniformed police officers with guns, clubs, and mace, three squad cars and two paddy wagons, and a police captain. And I was in the dressing room getting ready for the show when they said, there's a police captain looking for a guy named McDonald. I said, oh, that's me. So I flushed my stash down the toilet, and I went out to see him. He was very tall, a blonde, green-eyed Irish police captain. That was a requirement for making captain back in Boston back then. Maybe that's changed. I don't know. He said, the Worcester police called us and told us about the show last night. I said, oh, that's great. He said, no, pal, don't say it here. I said, what's it? He said, you know what I mean. I said, no, I don't know what you mean. He said, yes, you do know what I mean. I said, no, I don't know what you mean. He said, yes, you do know what I mean. So he was turning red and shaking all over. The sergeant pulled me over to the side, and he said, come on, be a little cooperative. I said, okay. He said, well, don't say it here. I said, what's it? He said, you know what I mean. I said, no, I don't know what you mean. Well, I wanted to hear him say it, but, you know, there was a rule then. Cops couldn't say fuck on duty in Boston. But that's changed today. Oh, my God. This poor girl. Did you bring earplugs? I'm sorry. Oh, my God. I'm corrupting youth. Every time my wife swears and I say, what do you talk like that? She says, it's your fault. I guess it is my fault. I'm corrupting a new generation. Anyway, he took me back to the captain. The captain said, if you say it here, we're going to beat you up and we're going to take you to jail. I said, oh, I know what you mean. So we went back in the dressing room. We had a band meeting, and we discussed whether we wanted to get beaten up and taken to jail. And we decided, no, we didn't want to. So we decided to do the love cheer that night. And we were up on stage. There was behind Chicken's drums was 25 guys and playing in trench coats with sunglasses and crew cuts. They weren't our roadies. We could see the paddy wagons out behind the door there, you know, and the cops were just standing right in front of the stage, and the captain was looking at me the whole show. And so we did the love cheer that night. It thoroughly confused the audience. But after the show was over, the captain came over. He put his arm around me, and he said, "It was a great show. Come back anytime you want." I said, "Oh, fuck you." So I thought that was the end of it, and the band broke up. Every time the band went on the road, the band came back to Berkeley and broke up. And so I had a solo career again, and about 3 months later, I got a job working in Massachusetts, and my lawyer, Peter Frank, by the way, said, "No, you can't go to Massachusetts." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because there's a warrant for your arrest in Worcester, Massachusetts, for leading the crowd in a lewd, lascivious, and wanton cheer." And I didn't know what those words meant, but it didn't matter. I was going to get tried anyway. So we got a Boston, we got a Massachusetts lawyer, and I flew in to Worcester, Massachusetts, and I was met at the airport in Worcester by Phyllis Hoffman, Abby Hoffman's sister, because the Hoffman family had a medical supply house in Worcester, which might explain Abby's behavior a little bit. And so Phyllis and I go to the courthouse, and we find the courtroom where my trial's going to be, and we try to get in. And Phyllis is stopped by the sergeant of arms at the door, and he says, "No, women are not allowed in the Worcester court with slacks on." And she says, "Oh, that's cool." So she goes into the toilet and takes her pants off and wraps her coat around her waist and comes back, and he says, "Okay, come on in." So she comes on in, and the trial starts. They brought two women from a New York State college who'd been at the concert that night, and they put them on the stand, asked them if they were offended by the cheer, and they said no, they weren't. So there was no one left in the courtroom except, you know, Phyllis and the stenographer, the judge, me, my lawyer. So the prosecuting attorney put me on the stand to prove I was offended by the cheer. Which I thought was a gutsy tack to take. I didn't think it would really work, though. He said, "Mr. McDonald, you have a daughter, right?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Try to imagine her and her friends are standing around on the corner saying, 'You know what?'" I said, "Who started it?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, I don't know what to tell you then." He said, "Okay, forget about that. Imagine you sit down to dinner one night and your daughter says, 'Pass the fucking salt.' What do you think about that?" I said, "Well, she's only 2 years old. It'd be her first coherent sentence. I'd be proud of her." Well, the judge didn't find that profound or funny. He was 87 years old. It was the last case that he prosecuted in his term, as he had been appointed 40 years before as a favor by the governor. And he looked over at me and he said, "I don't get it. What's the connection between this obscene chant thing in a song about the war in Vietnam?" And I said, "Upon finding out you're going to Vietnam, you would say, 'Oh, fuck.'" Well, he didn't get that at all. He fined me $50. We appealed the case, and it was later thrown out of court. The whole thing cost me about $3,500. It cost me $3,500. But I was framed because each member of the band took one letter. I don't know which letter they took, and the fifth person yelled to the audience, "What's that spell?" And then the audience yelled the word. See what I mean? Yeah. So, anyway, judging by the inflated cost of weed and gasoline, that would be about $30,000 today. But anyway, I got that great story out of it, and there you go. There you go. I got the story. So, yeah, what the hell do I do now? Well, I'll do this song, yeah. through the song. Yeah, music is great. I guess I could do stand-up comedy, but I only have those two stories. People always tell me, oh, those stories. I need more stories than that for my own TV show. I asked before if I could say those words at the Commonwealth Club. I don't know how many people have said language like that at the Commonwealth Club before. Maybe it's a first, I don't know. Is that a good thing in my resume? To be a person, it's broadcast on the internet, I understand. And I was told that once a week or once a month, NPR picks a certain recorded Commonwealth talk to broadcast on KQED and public television. And I don't think that story will be there. I don't think so, because it's like $300,000 fine for saying fuck. Which is weird, you know, seriously speaking. I've always used the language of working class people because of my socialist upbringing for my music. And it is strange that our means of communication is controlled by the 1%, the upper class. That's strange when you think about it. So it's pretty well limited the success of my career. That wasn't an intention of mine, but plug your ears, dear. Cover her ears. I've probably done damage already, but so I usually dedicate the cheer to the commander in chief, and I've dedicated. In this great land of ours, the commander-in-chief is always a civilian and of our military forces, and I've dedicated the fuck cheer to quite a number of presidents over the year. In the first term of Barack Obama, I stopped dedicating the fuck cheer to the commander-in-chief because the liberals in my audience were going, whoa, whoa, whoa. But in the end of his second career, I think most people can feel pretty relaxed about dedicating the fuck chair to the commander-in-chief, Barack Obama, who sits there with his drones killing people in Syria. Oh, that's not entertaining. Give me an F!
F!
Give me a U!
U!
Give me a C!
C!
Give me a K!
K!
What's that spell?
Fuck.
What's that spell?
Fuck.
What's that spell?
Fuck.
On all of you big strong men, Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books, pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up pearly gates. Yeah, it ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. Come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Man, this war a go-go. There's plenty good money to be made. Supplying the army with the tools of the trade. Just up and pray, pray, drop the bomb. Drop it on the Viet Cong. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Yeah, it ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. generals, and let's move fast. Your big chance is here at last. Now you can go out, get those reds. The only good commie is one that's dead. You know that peace can only be won when they've blown them all to kingdom come. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up pearly gates. Yeah, it ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. Come on, mothers, throughout the land, pack your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate. Send your daughters off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block. Have your kids come home in a box. And it's 1, 2, 3. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's the end of my whatever this is. And now I think we're going to have
Country Joe
questions. Here's a microphone.
Well, perhaps they're
or you can just yell it out if you want. Okay, I'll take the credit. I'll take it. Do I get a little, you know, something?
Look at it.
50 years of notoriety. It paid the bills, yes. And I didn't get arrested. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Pat Bunker, I'm a retired hospice nurse and cannabis advocate. I just wanted to make one brief statement, is that the banana joints were better if you sprinkle a little hash in them.
Yeah.
The other thing is to get back to music now. Anybody who's not aware of an organization called Alive Inside, I would highly recommend it. It's a program that takes iPods into residential homes, and it programs in the favorite music of folks from when they were young. And the amazing changes that you see happen to folks who have been like totally incommunicado for years, when they hear the music that is the story of their life, is pretty amazing. So it's Alive Inside, and please check it out.
Alive Inside.
Yeah.
Great. Any other questions? Good. Okay. Oh, I have my wife is back there at that table. I brought some CDs and a couple of photographs if you want to buy some merch. That's where the profit is. All in the merch. The Commonwealth club doesn't pay anything.
Hello?
But you know, I can now say that I work the same venue as Kim Kardashian. And you know, the chair that she sat on is on eBay now for $10,000. Yeah. Okay. You have another question? No? No? Just yell. Oh, I have a little story about that, yes. Because Donovan had a song called Mellow Yellow. Right? Remember? And so I was at the Cleveland Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for some due, and Donovan was there. He had a nice velvet red jacket. And I said to him, Donovan, was Mellow Yellow about smoking banana? And he said, what do you think? And he turned and walked away from me. Anyway, I'll be back at the table if you want to tell me some stupid story from the 60s that you think happened or whatever. Thank you. Thank you very much.